During World War II, the United States ran a top-secret project in the Los Alamos Desert called the Manhattan Project. Intelligence reports warned that Germany was on the brink of harnessing nuclear energy to create weaponry, and so the race was on. J. Robert Oppenheimer and a host of the best minds of the 20th century gathered to solve an intriguing puzzle. How do you split an atom? This puzzle was at the heart of the project. The memoirs of the physicist Richard Feynman were rife with the antics and camaraderie of those scientists who were thrown together to decipher it. My father, a working physicist during World War II, received letters, which I found in a steamer trunk after he died, from colleagues telling of the project they were working on, which he, had he been an American citizen, might also work on. The project was very hush-hush. When Trinity, which was the name they called the bomb, was tested in the desert, J. Robert Oppenheimer told the story that when he saw the results of his work, what went through his mind was a quote from the Bhagavad Gita, and he said, "I am death, the destroyer of worlds." Fun fact, years later, another scientist who was standing beside him remembers that all he really said was, "Oh, it worked." But the other story carries with it so much more gravitas. Shortly thereafter, the only two atomic bombs that had ever been used were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing 100,000 people outright, and causing the deaths of countless others who afterward died of their injuries or died slowly from radiation poisoning over the next several decades. J. Robert Oppenheimer spent the rest of his adult life trying to convince people to regulate, control, and mitigate the possible effects of nuclear weaponry. For his efforts to try and stop the development of the hydrogen bomb, he was stripped of his place on the Atomic Energy Commission, brought before the House Un-American Activities Committee, and stripped of his top secret clearance. In the excerpt I chose for the reading this morning, his address before the American Philosophical Society in 1945, he tried to paint a brighter side to the creation of atomic weaponry, but as a cautionary tale, he realized the potential of the magnitude of the peril as our one great hope, as a further argument against war. Because of its vast threat to all people on the earth, it had become a unique opportunity. It became a practical thing for us to avert atomic war, a practical thing to recognize our common responsibility, which is wholly incapable of unilateral solution, and that it would take a community of responsibility for meeting the peril of war. In other words, he saw how it was not only through recognizing our common bond with all people everywhere that we would be able to solve the problem brought on by the possibility of nuclear war. It was an impetus for people everywhere to start talking to each other, realizing our common humanity, and working together to end even the possibility of such worldwide destruction. His dream did not come to fruition, even though we have never again used atomic weaponry. We have figured out innumerable ways to build weapons of mass destruction, and we haven't ended war. Iowa was this very extreme example of a technological breakthrough, a product of innovation and creation of the greatest minds of the time, that today still carries with it ethical dilemmas far beyond whether or not it should ever engage in a nuclear war. Many of the technologies that we find ourselves faced with today are not at the same magnitude of the possible destruction of the entire world, but create ethical dilemmas of a kind we may not necessarily notice as dilemmas until way beyond the time we adopt them. They may not even be dilemmas that their creators could have foreseen. Systems theorist Margaret Wheatley writes in her book, So Far From Home, Lost and Found in Our Brave New World, once a technology enters the culture, it takes over. It feeds on itself, assisted by our eager adoption of the technology and our demands for more of it. Social structures, values, behaviors, politics can't help but organize around the technology's values. The predictable result is the loss of existing cultural values and traditions and the emergence of a new culture. This happens all the time with new technologies like fire, the printing press, indoor plumbing, the telephone, television, and the internet. It is the natural progression of humans of unlimited creative potential. But as technologies emerge faster and faster, so much so that we can no longer keep up, we lose our ability to notice what they are doing to us, much less taking the time to thoughtfully discern their consequences, both good and bad, and how the technology will affect and change our culture. In the book, The Driver in the Driverless Car, the authors Vivek Wada and Alex Salkeeper describe some of the emerging technologies we can expect in the coming decades. There are many that are truly life-changing and can be beneficial to people across the socioeconomic spectrum. But many of them, the authors concede, can lead to the utter destruction of the world, though not nearly as quickly as a nuclear bomb. And so they ask three questions about the technologies. Does it have the potential to benefit everyone equally? What are the risks and rewards? Does it promote autonomy or dependence? The technologies in the driverless car include personal in-home diagnostics for all medical care. The aforementioned driverless car, i.e. a car you hire that comes to your house and takes you where you need to go, that is completely computer-driven, driven on roads and with other driverless cars who have embedded sensors so as to prevent accidents. I'm still not fully convinced this will ever work. Smart homes that have embedded sensors so that the smart thermostats, refrigerators, washers and dryers, and cameras can monitor and respond to our every need, recommending a new flavor of ice cream or a new brand of clothing, and generating innumerable amounts of data on each of us at any given time, ostensibly for our benefit. 3D printers that can make anything from printable food to printable organs, like a spare kidney made from printable ink derived from our own stem cells. We can have electro-nanosensors swimming throughout our bodies, constantly monitoring and giving us information about our health that, the authors write, will preempt serious health problems and enable prescription of proactive behavior and therapies. The caveat being that if biohacking becomes a branch of computer hacking, the sensors that help keep us alive can also be used to kill us. Right after they write this, they ask the question completely seriously. Why would we replace parts of our body with our own cells when in many cases a better, long-lasting, more digital alternative exists? And I say, see, previous caveat. The authors laud the idea that artificial intelligence will render almost every occupation, from doctors and lawyers to fast food and factory workers, obsolete. And in a burst of optimism, they write, look ahead at this jobless future that technology is creating. If the needs and wants of every human being are met, there are technologies that they suggest, we can deal with the social problems and the psychological problems of joblessness. And they do this without wrestling with the problem that if no one has jobs, who will be able to afford their amazing technologies? The authors also claim that with these amazing technologies, they will be able to end poverty, also without wrestling with the fact that even without many of those technologies described, we already have the capacity to alleviate poverty, hunger, homelessness, healthcare disparities, but we don't always have the political will to do so. And creating shiny new technologies will not necessarily change that. Just like the old saying, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks at like a nail. If all you have is a designer working on emergent technologies, everything looks like an app. Even when an app is not the only solution, or even the solution at all. In this brave new driverless car world, it seemed to me as I was reading that human beings were meant to become superfluous. Their only purpose in this world, it seemed to me, was to be the grateful recipients of the talents of artificial intelligence, and to simply accept that and adapt accordingly. It is a world of ultimate connectivity that I think of no actual connection. It is a disembodied and dehumanizing world in which the comfort of the individual is paramount. There was almost no mention of the more than human world of plants and animals. There was no mention of where the resources that were going to power this technological revolution were going to come from. Who was going to mine the materials needed for all this innovation? Where and under what conditions? And at what cost to the natural world? It is a world in which intelligence is measured purely by how fast a person or a thing can process information and generate feedback. It is an intelligence merely of the neck up. It is a world designed by cleverness. Wisdom, on the other hand, sits in our whole embodied selves and all those things in which we come in contact. The trees, flowers, animals, insects, other people. It realizes that we are not individual, animized beings whose wants and needs are not caught up in the wants and needs and desires of everything around us. That connection to other humans, except during, of course, this period of coronavirus, whether they can cure us or have ultimate utility for us or not, contribute to our well-being. That our ability to grow things in the soil that we plant, nurture, grow, and eat may take a little longer than a 3D printer, but the weight is worth the effort and the connection made by doing so. The idea that we simply stop every so often to review, evaluate, perhaps rethink our technological decisions instead of always rushing forward might be a wise choice. In many cases, our innovations and creations are simply our longing to connect to something larger than ourselves. But they have impacts that are way different from those that we intended. It would be wise to evaluate both our intention and its impact. The real lives of living, breathing humans and the more than human world sometimes hang in that balance. Maybe our homes are places where we care for and nurture each other, places of rest and peace, not places of continuous information feedback loops. I know I don't want my refrigerator to tell me what to eat and what not to eat. I don't want everything within which I live and move and have my being collect data on me. I know this is already happening. I'm not lying. In an already distracted world, do we need more distractions? In our story this morning, three questions are asked. When is the best time to do things? Who is the most important one? What is the right thing to do? It reminds us that this moment and those who are with us in this moment, those are the ones to whom we should be present. Those are the ones to whom we should be attending. When we are distracted, even now, by the technology we already have, we do not always attend to those who are right in front of us. This lesson is particularly prescient in this time. Carl and I have this book. It's called The Wisdom of the Amish. I keep trying to get rid of it because we've had it for a long time and neither one of us has read it in decades. But it came up this week when I was thinking about this sermon. In the book, it tells about how the Amish screened new technology. If the use of a device would significantly disrupt their way of life or compromise their separation from the English, which is what they call outside people, its use is forbidden. The fact that the new device might save labor or increase efficiency does not override the primary concern of protecting a way of life. The Amish have decided they will control technology, not be controlled by it. I don't want to be Amish, but surely we can be thoughtful about emerging technology. Learn how to control it rather than being controlled by it. Decide how quickly or whether we want to adopt it at all. Reevaluate over and over and over again its benefits and consequences. Just because we can do something, should we? If we choose wisely and well, we will be able to say, we are life. We are the preserver of worlds. Amen. And blessed be.